Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is Joanne Leadham Ackerman, who is a novelist, short story writer, and journalist whose works of fiction include Burning Distance, The Dark Path to the River, and No Marble Angels. Her recent nonfiction book, Pen Journeys, Memoir of Literature on the Line, drew inspiration from her job as a vice president of the worldwide writers and human rights organization, Pen International. She is also on the boards of the American Writers Museum, the International Center for Journalists, Words Without Borders, and Refugees International. The book we're talking about today is The Far Side of the Desert, which is her latest novel. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Joanne.
Thank you so much.
So,
looking forward to it.
You have quite a broad range of work that you've done, but it seems like is there a common thread through all of this?
Yes, and then just to, I know these bios went out in the interim between it going out, I'm now emeritus on the Refugees International Board, having served for 12 years, and on the International Center for Journalists, which I served for about 24 years, I think. The theme for me in a lot of the work I've done that hasn't been writing has dealt with human rights, with freedom of expression, and with education. Those are three areas that have been very important to me, and I've had the opportunity to work with organizations that target those areas and try to help in each venue, and have served on the boards, which allows me to have oversight to visit sites and to be active, and as well as writing. And it also has helped me as a writer because I've been able to see a lot of places in the world through those prisms and lenses.
Oh, wow. How did you get started in this work?
You know, I tell people, you live long enough, you do lots of things. I grew up in the South. I grew up in Texas, and in the 50s and the 60s. And I was always, for reasons I can't quite tell you, because it was, as a very young child, really, you know, disturbed with segregation. I was very much a vocal youngster in terms of civil rights and women's rights. And those were not always perceived quite the same. So I was thought I would be a lawyer and be able to argue with people. And then I decided I probably would cry in front of a jury. So I moved into being a writer. But I would, these issues were important to me. So it was just sort of natural. And when I began writing, I began my career as a journalist. So I would be out covering issues. I worked in Boston, where I covered, the big segregation issues up there for a while. I just worked in various places as a reporter. But as a reporter, you're looking at the world from the outside in, and you're describing it from the outside. And what always interested me was sort of the inside, with the people, the characters, the people who sort of formed what the news were and what that was inside. And that's what led me to fiction. But my interest in both the inside and the outside also took me to being a bit of an activist. So when I was working, I just had moved to Los Angeles and was invited to a dinner of Penn, which I'd barely heard of at the time. And they worked on behalf of writers around the world who found themselves imprisoned or disappeared or even killed because of their writing in places that were, you know, did not have free expression. And that just touched my heart, and I began working on their behalf. And so that began one road. And then from Penn, Human Rights Watch asked me to get involved with them because they deal in many human rights. I work with Save the Children, which deals with education around the world. So just one activity led to the next activity, as life does. So there was no plan, but it just, you know, I met those people and they said, oh, well, how about being here? And it just, the path opened. It was not once planned, but it coincided with what, I guess I followed my passions. That's probably the short answer.
Well, it was not a common thing for women of your generation to get that involved in the world. So,
well, I don't know. You know, I have colleagues who certainly did, but you're right. I mean,
yeah.
Many of my friends still. I'm back in Texas actually today for a writer's event in my hometown of Dallas, and you know, there are many people that didn't venture out, but their hearts and passions are still there. They've just been in one place exercising them.
Well, and now that, you know, when we talk about it, or when you, that there are quite a few Texas women who really have made their mark in the broader world from your generation. I'm thinking of, and maybe they're a little older than you, but Ann Richards and Molly Ivins and the attorney who did Roe versus Wade, wasn't she from Texas too?
I'm not sure. They are probably just a decade or generation older, but yes, but you know, if they say once a Texan, there's some party that's always a Texan, and I identify that as being sort of an independent spirit and having a voice in your surroundings, and that, you know, that I'm glad to have, however I got it. And you do begin, and because Texas is always proud of being such a large state, I just took that out and realized how large the world was and how much there was in the world I didn't know and wanted to learn about. So I got out and had the ability to see a lot of the world, I'm happy to say.
Now, as a journalist, were you working all around the world?
No, not necessarily reporting. One of the first big stories I did, I was living in London, and I did a freelance story with photographs and everything on Hyde Park. And it was published in the Christian Science Monitor. And I went on to be a reporter at the Christian Science Monitor. And I covered events. I was in Boston. I covered events that dealt with Vietnam at the time, dealt with Europe and wage price controls and all of that. But my base was in Boston. I wasn't abroad. But once I got abroad, I began doing freelance work abroad.
One of your main characters in The Far Side of the Desert is an international journalist.
Yes.
So
most of my work, looking back, in almost all the fiction I've written, somewhere in it is a journalist.
Okay.
Not the main character. Somewhere, that's sort of, there's usually a journalist, and then somewhere in the stories is a child. And, you know, there's just certain points that sort of frame the work. And a journalist is sort of there seeing what is from the outside. And they're placed in different roles. In my earlier novel, Burning Distance, it was a mother. In The Dark Paths of the River, the main characters were all journalists. So somewhere there's usually a journalist. It's sort of also a security point, I guess, for me.
And it's something that you obviously know a lot about, so maybe don't have to do a whole lot of research for that character.
Yeah. It's a life I didn't live throughout. But I lived adjacent to. Many of my closest friends are still out there in the field.
Really? Well, and you're still active with Penn International, correct?
Yes, I'm still vice president of Penn International.
Okay, I have to ask you about, I saw this list on social media of journalists killed in Gaza, and it was
quite long.
Yes, tragically long. I mean, how is this happening?
Well, that's such a big question, and one that I can't claim to have answers to, but it's a tragic result. And also in Gaza, journalists essentially are not allowed in. So those who've been killed have maybe been Palestinians that actually are there. It's very hard for journalists to get into Gaza right now. It's a tragedy all over. I mean, without even getting into politics, it's very hard to watch the level of death and killing in that whole region on whatever and all sides.
Right. Yeah. There's terrorism is terrorism, and murder is murder.
And it's,
whoever's doing it.
It's the world is needing to find a way to find their equilibrium through nonviolence. If you oppose something, to find a nonviolent way to oppose it.
Yes. Yeah. So tell us about The Far Side of the Desert, what the inspiration, what the book is about, and then what inspired it.
Okay. Well, the story opens in Santiago de Compostela, where there's an annual Camino, a big festival. And these three siblings, one is Samantha, who is a renowned international broadcast journalist. One is her brother, Cal, who is a diplomatic correspondent for The Economist. So this is, these are two journalists at the center of the story. And then their younger sister is Monty, who works for the State Department in Cairo. And they're all three sort of workaholics. They come from a sort of a foreign affairs family. Their father's been an ambassador. He's been at NATO. They've lived in many places in the world. And they work hard, and they just decided to take a couple of days together to see each other and have a vacation, because each was heading into a different phase of their life. Monty was off to an embassy in Indonesia. Cal was in the middle of a divorce. Samantha tried to bring them all together at this festival. But at the festival, there is a terrorist attack, and one of them is abducted and disappears, and just disappears. Nobody makes contact with the family. Nobody knows what's happened to this person, and the family goes into high gear to try to find her, but they can't. With all the tools they have, they simply cannot locate this person. And so the first part of the book is about that journey and the family coming together to do that, and the person who's, turns out, is deep in the Sahara Desert. And sort of each character coming to terms with issues of their own that deal with their own lives, and then coming back together, and then there are other big events that happen. I don't want to give away the plot, but big events both personally and then globally. And what's interested me in the fiction I like to read, and therefore try to write, is, as I say, I sort of have realized I operate in sort of three circles of narrative. And the outside circle is the world, and that's sort of the journalist circle. In this case, it deals with money laundering, drug trafficking, people trafficking, arms trafficking. That's sort of the outer circle. I try to research it well. You know, even if the facts change a little bit, I sort of have done the research. And then the middle circle is the community around them, in this case, the family and the community. And then the very inner circle are the main characters in what they're dealing with. And in any novel, if done well, the themes of the book play in all three of those, and the action and the plot, you know, operates in all three of those zones. But that's sort of the way that, in sort of analyzing my own stories, I realized that's what I've been doing in almost all of the novels that I've written. And in this case, it deals with those issues of the criminality that really is at the heart of most terrorism. These are very often criminal enterprises. They're funded by, you know, drug trafficking, arms trafficking, and the whole criminal drops over society. And even in developed world, the criminal membrane will drop over that society and inhibit its development and its growth.
And there are people who don't consider themselves criminals, that, or we wouldn't look at them as criminals, who are actually aiding and abetting this.
That's often true. It's often true. And it's a challenge. You know, it's a challenge, because very rarely does a person see themselves as a criminal. I mean, you know, most people rationalize their behavior. And in coming to terms with the antagonists in a book, it's important to understand how the world looks through their eyes, you know, as a writer. So you can't, if you don't want to just have flat, you know, characters that are sort of your straw men to knock down, you have to come to terms with who that person is and how they're viewing the world through their eyes, which is not the same. And that, for me, is often the challenge in the writing that I've done, to really come to terms with the, quote, bad guys and try to get into who they are so the reader can see them. Because essentially what a good novel should do, I think, is open up one's view and develop empathy, not sympathy or approval, but empathy of, well, what did that world look like and why are they doing that? These terrible things. And they're still the bad guys, but as a writer, you have to be able to sort of see through that. And for me, what I tend to do to get there when I really find it hard is just keep going back into their story. Who are they? You know, most babies are not born to be bad guys. So how far do I have to go back to understand what happened in their lives that began influencing who they are? And that isn't often in a book, but it has, as a writer, you do that until you really can come to terms with that character. So you can be confident in the voice that they're offering you.
So you know a lot more backstory of the characters than what shows up in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's essential. And as a writer, what you learn as you develop as a writer and a novelist is how to not put what doesn't need to be put in the book, because often, especially a young novelist, will have a lot of scaffolding, which is all is telling all this story to themselves to make the characters real. But the reader doesn't have to know that. They just have to know the character's real. And then you have to get rid of the scaffolding.
Mm.
And just put the page. That's
well,
a little bit of the...
I noticed in your writing, it was very, what I would call, spare. Pardon?
That's the journalist, you know.
Yes, yes. So it's not that you don't give descriptions of things, but there's points in the story where you kind of skip over where someone another writer might describe this entire thing of action, and you skip over all of that and go to the next high point in a sense.
Part of the challenge for me is, you know, dialogue is very easy for me. So when I, in fact, the book I'm writing now, I just tell myself, okay, this is first draft, don't worry about it. I mean, I literally just run the book dialogue, and it's just scene, dialogue. Because I hear those, I hear the characters talking, I hear what's happening, I see it. And then I have to go back and, you know, fill in sometimes the description, the theme, the nuance, the texture of the story. And that's, I realize, is sort of just the nature. Everybody has their, you ask a writer what's hard for you, what's easy for you. So for some writers, they say, gosh, dialogue is so hard. And I say, oh my gosh, dialogue is so hard. But you know, for me, but you know, these other things. So, you know, sitting and actually describing a face to me is a challenge because, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, how do you really get into the description? So I go back in my second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, however many drafts, adding texture, adding that. But as a journalist, you know, you learn and have to be spare. You know, when I first shifted from being, I was a reporter and I took a leave of absence to go back to graduate school, and I was at Brown, and I handed in like my first 14 pages to the novelist, and he says, "What is this? This should be 40 pages. Why is it, you know, so spare?" And I said, you know, I'm just, you know, no extra words. You go from here to there. So I had to learn to expand.
Right. You know, expand. Right. Yeah. In The Far Side of the Desert, did you start with one specific character when you were sort of imagining this?
In that particular book, I think I started more with the place.
Okay.
Because people ask me, you know, where did it begin? And it's hard to remember because this book began many years ago and went through many drafts, and, you know, it just iterated. It didn't go straight from first draft to publication. But as I go back, the story that I come back to is I was actually in Santiago de Compostela where Penn International was holding its annual Congress. And at that Congress, I was elected what was called chair of the International Writers in Prison Committee. And that's the head of all the human rights work that Penn does. And because I was elected to run that, I was at a small dinner of a special guest Penn had at the time, the only time we've had to go through metal detectors. This was in the 90s. And our special guest was Salman Rushdie, who was still under the heavy hand of the fatwa. And Salman, along with, you know, a few others, and sat next to him. And I began thinking, what would it be like to have to vacate your whole life? All the things that, you know, sort of you thought were your, you know, your family, your career, everything that you thought was who you were. And that was just the beginning of the idea, the theme, if you will. And so when I went to write it, I began writing the scene in Santiago de Compostela. And, you know, I had my journalist character and I had the family, the sister, and it began developing that way. But I often am writing knowing parts and points that the novel is going to, but not the whole. And some people classify, I think it's bit of a facile classification, but nonetheless, classify the way novelists write as the plotters and the pantsers.
Right, right.
Plot it all out, and the pantsers write by the seat of their pants. Well, if I'm in one of those categories, I'm the pantser, because I know this much, I see that much, I see here. But part of the fun is finding out where the story's going and what the characters are going to do, because they become quite alive in your head. And they begin talking back to you and say, I'm not going to do that. No, this is not right. You're going to. And that's
to me, the fun of the book is the discovery that the writer has in that first draft, where you think it's going here, but oh my gosh, it went there. That's so interesting. Ah, that, you know, so that's to me part of the fun of writing. And then you have a first draft and you begin shaping it and crafting it as though you knew what you were doing all along. But anyway, so for me, the story began, it often begins with character, but this is, in this case, it was coincidental character and setting as the novel began. As I began researching it, I found out the very end of that Camino is a place called Finisterre, Spain, on the coast, and it's where the ancients thought the world ended, and they thought the sun set there, and if you went any further, you fell off a cliff. And another big setting in the book is Gibraltar, and there, the ancients thought that that was the entrance to the River Styx, and there was a tunnel that connected Africa and Asia. So the mythology in Hercules is there too. There was this wonderful mythology that began playing as I began researching and thinking about this book, that began playing in this story, the mythology of, you know, Hercules and the Greeks. And that was fun. And I would not have known that from the beginning, but I got into the book and began doing the research. And, you know, those are gifts that were given to me to put into the book.
Now, have you been to all the places that you write about in this book?
More than once. Privilege about making sure, except I have not been so deep into the Sahara. I've been to the Sahara, but I haven't been as deep as this book setting. But yes, every place. And in a place like Gibraltar, which I went to many times checking that I had it right, the last trip I took, because the book took a while, they had changed the way you entered the caves. So rather than enter from the top and go down to the bottom, you enter from the bottom and went to the top. And I went, wait, that's, you messed up my whole book. No. This is set in 2007, and that's the way it was in 2007. So, you know, but no, I scrupulously try to check details. And then I allow my imagination to go too. So sometimes I know it wasn't quite like that, but I know it wasn't, and it's okay that I don't have it quite right, because it doesn't really affect anything except, you know, where the story's going.
Now, are those caves actually used to store arms?
Yes. Yes, wow. They are. They get to where the arms are, but yes, to store, you know, you know, historically and now, even I think NATO still uses them, but yes, they have a deep history, an interesting history.
Wow.
And many people who go to Gibraltar have never been to the caves, and that's sort of the magic of that little rock.
I haven't ever been to Gibraltar, although I've seen it, I think, because I took a ferry from Malaga over to Morocco, and I think you could see Gibraltar from there.
Probably. Yeah. But it's a very tiny but very interesting place and interesting history that goes with it. And what happens in the book is the fun of the writing, because as you get into it, do the research, make sure you just find these sort of secrets and histories, and that you can then weave into the tale as well.
Wow. So the family, you know, you have the three siblings and then their parents. Are they based on an actual family?
No, not really. Those are pretty created. I mean, I have a sister, but, you know, we have a different relationship, but I know what it is to be, and I'm an older sister. So I know the dynamic of, you know, of sisters. And no, they're pretty much created and fun. I mean, I enjoyed creating the family I didn't necessarily have.
And the grandmothers, so I found that part really interesting.
Yeah, I love the grandmothers. A grandmother and a great, I mean, the grandmother's 94 and the great grandmother's 104. And the great wisdom of the book, and this was a complete gift to me from those voices in my head. And most writers will tell you that the characters do come alive in an odd way and begin telling you things. And these grandmothers, to me, gave the great wisdom of the book at the very end. Mm. And I went, oh, thank you. I mean, I didn't think, you know, I just thought it was, they were so wise. And I really wanted, originally I wanted the great-grandmother to be even older. My agent said, oh, please don't make her more than 104. Nobody wants it. I said, okay. Because I wanted a character that had really seen an entire century and had sort of carried history within her, because it had been part of her life and she'd witnessed it and she'd lived in Washington and, you know, she knew it. So I wanted that voice. They're not everywhere in the story, but
crucial parts.
Right. In case someone's wondering how one generation can be 94 and the other 104, they're different sides of the grandmothers from different sides of the family.
Yeah.
Grandmother
different
and great-grandmother. Yeah. But they lived together. And I was just charmed by that.
And one of them actually graduated from a school that I went to. She was one of the first students. And she was there, the oldest, the great-grandmother was there, you know, before women's suffrage. And the school in Dallas is called Hockaday. And she, you know, she was one of the earliest students. And that, you know, that was one of the just the wedges of women having any voice and any, you know, rights in the world. And I found that was, you know, that was fun to do. So I do link when I can to, you know, little tidbits like that.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Joanne Leadham Ackerman, author of The Far Side of the Desert. Joanne, could you read a little bit from the book?
Sure, I'd be glad to. What I might do is just read the opening of the opening chapter.
Perfect.
Dateline, July 2007. A Moorish king and queen bobbed momentarily above Samantha Waters' scrambled eggs as if waiting to be fed. Outside the second-floor windows of the Hospital de los Catolicos, 12-foot puppets of kings and queens and devils and saints peered into the dining room, then lurched away toward the square. Samantha leaned over the balustrade and filmed the festivities on the plaza below. "Let's go, Monty," she urged. Her sister, who was hunched over the wooden table with a plate of pancakes, "We can get coffee on the plaza." Outside, the smell of coffee and fresh almond cakes rose from the pushcarts as pilgrims hurried past, shaking their tambourines, beating their drums, and filling the morning air with sound. Somewhere bagpipes played. The sun was already baking the cobblestones on the square, where tables and chairs had been set up. "It's too crowded," Monty complained, as they merged with a stream of dancers and musicians. "This is a security nightmare. It's a festival." Samantha spotted an empty table and tossed her black straw hat over the heads of other spectators to claim it. They'd arrived late last night, she from London and Monty from the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. At breakfast, they'd read the guidebook, which explained how a monk in the 9th century had discovered the body of the apostle in the king and queen's home village. The village had been celebrating its destiny ever since. "Remind me why we came here," Monty blinked into the sun. "We're not Catholic. Are you doing a story?" "We used to live in Spain. I thought it would be fun to come back." "We lived in Madrid, not Galicia, 30 years ago," Monty said. "You are doing a story. You're always doing a story." A correspondent for the international news network, INN, Samantha conceded the point, "but not today. I'm hoping Cat will get here too." Their elder brother was flying in from Washington en route to a magazine assignment in Turkey. "It's beautiful here and filled with history," Samantha added. "Everywhere in Europe is filled with history. Cairo is filled with even more history." Monty pulled off her khaki jacket, rolled up her shirt sleeves, and unbuttoned the waistband of her slacks, which is pinching her. "I wanted to see you before you disappeared on your new assignment," Samantha said. She watched her sister, who seemed more irritable than usual. Monty's pixie-like features were still young, but she put on weight, and her pale brown hair flared into gray arrows at her temples. Monty was 37, married with 2 children. Samantha, still single, was almost 40, but looked like the younger sister. Samantha waved for the waiter that was threading among the tables. "I also wanted to cheer up Cal before his divorce, though none of us knows how to take a vacation." Monty pointed to the massive Baroque and Romanesque cathedral across the square, with twin towers rising over 200 feet like giant dripping sandcastles framing the facade. "How do they know it's the real body of the apostle in there?" she asked. Samantha read from the guidebook. "A hermit saw lights and heard music in the woods and found the body. Ever since, Santiago de Compostela has been the destination for pilgrims on their journeys of faith." "Faith in what?" Monty asked. "Even you don't have faith in 2,000-year-old bones." "No, but I have faith in festivals," Samantha smiled an easy smile. Monty frowned. "People want to believe in something larger than themselves, Monty." "Maybe, but that doesn't mean something exists." Monty fanned herself with the folded newspaper as the sun rose above the cathedral spire. She slid out of her heavy leather sandals and set her bare feet on top of them.
She glanced up at the sound of a helicopter circling above. Around him, tourists in shorts and t-shirts weaved among the supersized puppets whose wood-framed costumes balanced on the shoulders of the pilgrims. The crowd looked like a gathering of medieval giants and midgets. A 12-foot devil in a smiling white mask strode past with a troupe of musicians and set a few tables away. Suddenly, the street exploded with more tambourines, drums, horns, and laughter from the people dressed in 15th-century tunics. From the backpack at her feet, Samantha extracted a small video camera and began to film. "So you are doing a story," Monty said. "Just taking footage." Samantha planned to stay after the festival to research a story on drug and diamond smuggling along the Camino de Santiago, but she didn't want to tell Monty and disrupt their vacation. "I'm feeling pressure at work," she said. "Younger reporters are shadowing me, and the network is getting new management that doesn't care what I've done in the past." She set down her camera. "But this weekend, I'm not working. I want to be here so we can have time together. I want to hear about your new post. Do you even speak Indonesian?" "I'm studying. Though, frankly, I'd rather be studying ancient Greek." Samantha laughed. "You did that in college, didn't you?" She remembered her father's objection and bewilderment when Monty went off to Harvard and majored in ancient languages. "You planning to liberate the Parthenon?" Monty smiled for the first time, her small mouth revealing a slightly crooked front tooth. "Someday, I imagine myself sitting in a hut somewhere in old age, reading the wisdom of the antiquity in the original, with the ocean lapping outside my door." Samantha stretched her long legs into the plaza, then pulled them back when a pilgrim tripped over her sandaled foot. "I can't imagine anything beyond next Wednesday." "What happens next Wednesday?" "That depends on what happens Tuesday." "Don't you ever get tired of the pace?" Monty fished an ice cube from her drink and rubbed it along her neck, which was turning pink. Samantha took off her straw hat and handed it to Monty. She pulled her hair up in a ponytail off her neck. "Yes, but I don't know how to stop right now, though someday I'd like to have a child and a family." Now Monty laughed as she put on Samantha's big brimmed hat, which fit Samantha but dwarfed her. "Excuse me. That would slow you down. You have a father in mind I should know about? Anyone, any relationship over a few months?" Samantha's blue-green eyes momentarily lost focus, and she frowned. "That's unkind. No one since Evan." She looked back out on the square. "I'm sorry, I forgot. You never talk about him." "Because you're full of judgment," Samantha wanted to say, but she didn't. She just didn't talk about her partner who'd been killed last year filming in the hills of Afghanistan. "Thank you for bringing us together," Monty amended, and raised her glass in a toast. They sat watching the square in silence as a band with drums and tambourines started playing. Two tables away, a man from the hotel with unruly gray hair sat down and tipped his cap to them. Samantha nodded. Monty didn't acknowledge him, but Samantha thought she saw him. Across the square, the devil put on his white mask and weaved towards them. Maybe I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. That was Joanne Leadham Ackerman reading from The Far Side of the Desert. So you mentioned that this book took quite a few years. Were you working on other projects at the same time?
Yes, I was. When I first wrote it, and the first time, whatever, I don't remember what draft it was, it didn't get bought right away. I was writing another book, and then I went back to this one. And I just iterated that way because, you know, essentially I'm a writer, so I just write. And my students always used to ask me, how do I know when I'm done? And my answer to them always was, when you're published. And until you're published, the book is always alive in your head. And so I would go back and then I would rewrite and I'd see new parts of it and I'd pull it together. And in writing the next book and the next, I became, of course, a better and better novelist along the way and could see how to edit and shape it. So, you know, any current writers or aspiring writers listening to this, just keep writing because you do get better and you do learn and you do see things and the book finds its shape and its voice and it works. So in a way, this is a better book than it would have been had it been published straight out. But I would have written more books had it been published straight out because I kept going back and I kept going back and, you know, and rewriting. But whatever it is, you know, a writer writes. That's just what writers do.
So how many novels have you published?
I've published, as novels, I've published 3 novels, a collection of short stories, and then I have about 2 or 3 more that are either in the works or ready to go out to the market.
Okay, so you started writing The Far Side of the Desert before you published your other novels?
Well, no, I had a novel published called The Dark Path to the River.
Okay.
And that was published. And then I have a novel called Burning Distance, and that was published just the year before The Far Side of the Desert. And then this one, and then I have 2 or 3 more. And then I have the novel that's, you know, in the drawer, probably never get published. And then a collection.
So that's the question. How did you know that this one was worth going back and redoing, whereas the others are...
I keep going back and redoing. Well, the one that's in the drawer, right? You know, unless somebody... The nice thing for me, though, it'd be better if the novels were, but I have 2 novels that the full novels didn't get published, but parts of them got published in my short story collection. So parts of them are published. You know, if anybody ever says, I want to see everything, then, I mean, I don't even know how many I can tell you. You know, you're going to have lots of manuscripts on your desk. But I have 2 that, that No Marble Angels has several stories from one novel that's called The Tutor, and I think 1 or 2 stories from a novel called The Other Side of Silence. And those were written, you know, decades ago. And, you know, I learned to be a writer. If I go back to them, I think I'm pretty happy with The Tutor. I think it's actually could work, you know, out there. But, you know, most writers can tell you they've got them. Even the really successful ones can tell you the novel's in the drawer. I remember once hearing Michael Cunningham, you know, who wrote The Hours, the beautiful writer, say all writers have one thing in common, failure. Because most writers will tell you before you knew them. Even I remember reading John Steinbeck's diaries and these were letters to his agent, Pascal Pavici. And I remember one statement I loved in his is he was getting rejection and rejection and rejection. And he wrote back to his agent and said, well, at least one more person has read my book.
Oh, wow.
So most writers have that. I mean, even the really successful ones, before anybody knew them, they were getting their, you know.
Right. Even Hemingway.
I mean, yeah. I don't know any writers that don't have their little stack of rejection letters, some more than others. But the thing is, when you really love writing and you love your doing, you just do it. And you do get better and you do see things. And some of those rejected books are probably quite brilliant and don't see the light of day. Or some get published and you go, how did that ever get rejected? I mean, that's a, you know, Nobel laureate.
Yeah, and then there's other books that you wonder how they ever got published.
How did they get published? Well, the one thing that, you know, if and when a writer can learn to get that monkey off their shoulder, his or her shoulder, it's great. You cannot compare yourself. Do not compare yourself. You know, and I just find, just be so happy when a good writer gets recognition, even if it's not you. Just be happy that that's possible in the world. And it just makes, you know, just makes you have a happier life, actually.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's not a zero-sum game.
No, and it's not a competition. No writer can write my book. They just can't. They don't live in my head. They haven't had my experience. And I can't write any other writer's book because we don't have the same life experience. We're not the same people. You know, we can learn from each other, but to be jealous of somebody else, it just doesn't make sense because nobody can do what you do. So because nobody can do what you do, then you need to do it. I mean, that's the imperative. You need to do it because nobody else can.
Now, The Far Side of the Desert is, I'd say, an international political thriller. Are all of your books in that same vein?
Well, I'm told they are. I never set out to write international political thrillers. But if people want to publish and read them, they all have that element of them. I mean, I set out to write the kind of books that I enjoy reading, which are books that have the world as in them one way or the other. So they connected to that. They're not just about somebody's own thoughts, which are good too, but those, and it just tends to move into that. The nice thing about being put in that category is that there is a whole body of readers and conferences and other things in it. I think the books are more than just that, but you know, what, whoever wants to buy them and read them, God bless. and publish them that way.
So let's talk about the title, The Far Side of the Desert. Where did the title come from? Which you, it is clear once you've read the book, but.
Well, originally the book was titled The Backside of the Desert. And the backside of the desert is from the Bible. And Moses goes to the backside of the desert near Horeb. So it's a, there's, you know, clear biblical references. He's, you know, coming to his terms and what's happening with him. But the publisher didn't like backside. And wanted me to change the title. And I said, well, I had debated backside or far side. Far side had its own possible challenges because of the cartoons of Far Side. So either one had, you know, something that people liked or didn't like. And the publisher didn't like backside. So I said, how about The Far Side of the Desert? They said, that's good. So I went with Far Side of the Desert. But the real allusion is to the biblical place, the backside of the desert, which is referenced in the novel.
Right, right. And the Sahara Desert is
huge.
It's huge, and it is possible to sort of hide there.
Well, what's interesting in this book and in Burning Distance, my earlier novel, I was writing about elements that were not in the news at the time and would have been fairly prescient had they been published at the time I first wrote, you know, had finished the first drafts. But they took a journey to get published, so now they're sort of historical. But when I was writing what was happening, in Sahara, nobody was paying attention to what was happening in the Sahara. Now, you know, there's a lot, people have realized there was a lot going on there in terms of terrorism and things. But I you know, my imagination just took me there and said, my gosh, look at this place and look at these elements and this. And then I began doing research, you know, so I was writing about it before, you know, people realized that, you know, Al-Qaeda was there and ISIS and others were out there. But in the research, I found that, in fact, because I was also thinking in my mind, my imagination just off the charts? And so as a journalist, you always want to say, well, check the facts. So I did enough research to find out, in fact, there was historically a place not quite like what is there, but it's close enough that I wasn't totally off the charts in my imagination, where a lot of training was done for what goes on there.
So is the villain character, the elder, is there somebody you had in mind, or
I wish that would be easier if I had it. He's out of my head, and there's the activity had some, but I had no model I was making after, and he's somebody I had to keep going back in his history and to realize, you know, he was born of a British mother and a Libyan father. And the mother dies when he's really young. The family doesn't really care about him in Britain. The father's off doing what he's doing. And he's put in boarding school at age 8, which is not unusual in Britain. It's sort of hard to imagine. And he also has a bit of a limp, so that makes him a target. And he's bullied. And, you know, but he's very smart, very smart. And so I was able to sort of start there and begin to see. And he had a different name. You know, he was, you know, his name was, you know, an Anglo name. But if you move through and you see what happened to him, then I could begin. But he's a character I sort of built. But in a way, it worked because it was also building the political dynamics of what's going on with this. You know, it has a political element to it.
Right, right.
But I've never met him. Mm-hmm. never met him.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Joanne Leadham Ackerman, author of The Far Side of the Desert. Joanne, I want to talk to you a little bit about your nonfiction book, Pen Journeys, Memoir of Literature on the Line. Can you tell me a little bit about that book?
Yes, I've been involved with Pen since the early 80s. And Pen was coming, there's several answers to that. In sort of the early 2000s, I was told you really need to have a website. So I said, okay, so I got a website. And the person who put it together beautifully, I think. And by the way, the website is www.joannleadham-ackerman.com. The person who put it together and does that for writers
told me you really need to blog. And I said, I didn't even know what a blog was. I said, I don't want to blog. I'm writing fiction. He says, you need to blog. I said, okay, I'll blog. Once a month, I'll blog. So I started doing a blog once a month. And I'm so grateful to him because since 2007, once a month, you can see what I was thinking all the way till now with a blog. And his pen was hitting its centenary in 2021. Oddly, it's an international writers group, but it was hard to find anybody that could write the history because it's so vast. And PEN has over 140 centers in 100 countries. So it was really hard to do that. And the president, who is a friend named Jennifer Clements, said, can you write anything? And I said, well, you know what? I do a blog once a month. I'll just write an episode. And I'll do two a month. I'll write an episode of my history with PEN because that's 30 years. And, you know, that's a third of the history. And then I can weave in the history. So I began writing a blog once a month, twice a month. Then I did three a month. And I did about 45 of them. And people said, this has got to be a book. You know, some writer friends said, I can't wait till the next one because I began weaving the history of PEN International into it. And when I was done, people really urged me to make it a book. And we found a publisher out of England called Shearsman. And so they published it as a book. And it's fun. It's really a dynamic, but it shows writers engaged in this around the world. A lot of writers will know, many you won't know, but it shows the activity of PEN coming together to work on behalf of literature and each other. And I hope it's a narrative. It's not just, you know, dry history.
And what are some of your, like, most moving stories from that?
Well, you know, I began my sort of international career. PEN had two centers in the U.S. at the time, one in New York and one in Los Angeles. And I was elected to head the Los Angeles Center. It happened to be the year of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie and Tiananmen Square. And we had an independent Chinese PEN Center. So those were two big events. And I remember, you know, I remember both of those. So those are in there. The other thing that I remember are huge international campaigns for writers, some of whom did not survive. One was Ken Sarawiwa in Nigeria and Anna Politkovskaya in Russia. And then, of course, and anybody who's involved in PEN, you know, knows where they were when the fatwa happened. They know where they were when Ken Sarawiwa was executed and when Anna Politkovskaya was down murdered. And, you know, and then there's just a lot of in between. I mean, there's so many stories. And it for me, it just gave me the opportunity to know writers from around the world and to be in places around the world, you know, including in, you know, the caves of Hasan Kaif, which is now flooded in Turkey, in southeast Turkey, in Diyarbakir, and, you know, to be in Morocco and to be in Cairo and just lots. And PEN is in all of these places with writers who offer their voice for writers who are not out there to give their voice. So it's been a real privilege. So it's a privilege for me to put this together and to show you what my journey was for all those years and many other people's.
I just have to ask, what does PEN think about what's happening with journalism in the U.S. today?
Well, PEN is very vigilant. I can tell you that. I mean, you know, it's the nature of it is to make sure that there's free expression. You know, democracy cannot exist without the freedom to express. And if we are not yet putting writers in prison, if that happens, then we are really on a downward slope. But there's enough censorship to go around to really raise an alarm. Because once you start censoring ideas and not letting people think and explore ideas, you know, explore ideas, you agree, you don't agree. The key is to be able to have a multiplicity of voices and be able to explore and listen and not ban ideas that you maybe disagree with, but put better ideas in front of them and have them come together and have a dialogue. So PEN is among the many organizations that's quite vigilant on freedom of expression.
With, you know, I you know, absolutely agree with that. I'm appalled by the censorship, the book banning. I mean, I saw a meme, which is totally true, that in my opinion, that when you look back at history, the people banning books are never on the right side of history.
No, absolutely.
On the other hand,
you don't want to be afraid. You don't want to be afraid of ideas. You know, yeah. But your other hand is mine.
And, you know, as parents, you want to have, you know, you want to know what your children are reading or whatever, but that doesn't mean you ban the books from the library.
No, no. But what I'm not thinking even about books. I'm thinking about the misinformation that is being put out in podcasts and social media and so forth that is just outright lies. And should we be controlling that in some way? Instead of banning books that are about, you know, sometimes just about somebody who lives a different lifestyle than you want to live, you know.
Yeah.
But then we're allowing this hate speech and outright falsehoods to spread all throughout the world.
Yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, social media and, you know, we're in a whole new kind of world. But once we start censoring and banning, then the question is, who's the banner and who's the censor? And so the usual answer, and I think they're definite borders. Once you start calling for violence and hatred that leads to violence, and you have the power to do it, then that's really. But just the ideas, even if it's a lie, you put out the truth. That's the best counter to the lie. Put out the light.
But you know Mark Twain's old saying, how a lie will make its way around the world before the truth even gets its shoes tied or something like that.
That's probably true. And it's a challenge is what one does. You know, I dealt a lot with that, especially in Europe, because America has very open ideas of freedom of expression. I mean, more than most countries, or at least we did. But, you know, Europe went through really hard times, so they're often much stricter on ideas. So it's a challenge where those restrictions are, how you enforce them. And it's not one simple answer. A basic line, though, to me and to Penn, I know, is if violence is involved, then that crosses the line. You know, if you have the power to execute that violence. If a poem says something and it advocates violence, you know, it's not wonderful, but it's one thing. If, you know, a government official does it who has the power to be violent, then that's something else. So it's a moving line. And you know, there's not an absolute that everybody can say everything all the time, like kill your neighbor or something. That doesn't work. But, you know, my neighbor is a, you know, goofball and something, something, you know, and then there's also recourse, you know, they're resourced through the courts, through civil action.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's moving and it changes according to time period and country. But the bottom line is free expression in the large is what keeps democracies.
Right. And so I'm very grateful for an organization like Penn who is monitoring this. And how, if somebody wanted to get involved with Penn, how would they do that?
Well, just go on the internet and type in Penn. There's Penn. If you're in the U.S., there's Penn American Center. It's the main center out of New York, but with branches around the country. Penn International has, you know, centers, as I said, in over 100 countries. And you just go on the internet and find it and connect, and they'll get back to you. That would be the way to do that.
So, Joanne, when you were ready to publish your first novel, did you have, how difficult was your path to finding a publisher?
The first novel, the publisher in a way found me because I had a short story collection that they had read and really liked and said they would like the novel, and I hadn't even finished the novel. So it was a smaller publisher, but it was distributed by W.W. Norton. And so they sort of took it out of my hands and said, "You're ready," before I really thought I was quite ready. So that was good. That was good. And it did quite well. You know, it was a front page of the LA Times Book Review. It was highly reviewed everywhere, and it did well. And I'm happy about that. So that was an easier process. But, you know, the publishing world keeps changing, and it's really changed a lot now. You know, we have a few major publishers, and then a lot of mid-list and smaller publishers, and then more than ever, self-published books out there through Amazon and other ways. So the publishing world, you know, as every industry, keeps changing. But the key is to just get out there. I find with novels, it's,
it's certainly beneficial to have an agent, if you have an agent, because at least the larger and many of the mid-sized publishers just have so much coming at them, they really almost require you to have somebody who's read it in front of you and says, yes, this is good, you should look at it. So I encourage writers, if they can, to find an agent first that can help them out. But it's not necessarily always required, but it's certainly
definitely useful. Yeah. How did you find your agent?
I've had several agents. The agent I have now was the friend, a close friend of a good friend of mine who was a major publisher. And she introduced us, and the agent liked the book a lot. And so I'm very lucky. She's become a friend and, you know, a lovely person to work with. She had, you know, 30 years experience with a major publisher herself, at a publisher, and her father had a publishing agency, which she took over. And so I'm lucky, Annalise Spitzer.
So you're working on another novel now?
Yes. I'm actually working on a sequel to a novel that's not yet published, so I hope I'll have two to put out into the market. And this one's writing very fast. I don't think I've had one sort of come so fast. But again, it's coming fast, and I'll need to go back and, you know, do all kinds of things before I put it out anywhere. But yes. So
but you're still having fun writing.
I love to write. And my happiest time of the day is when I'm sitting there writing. I'm happy most days away, but that's my favorite time of the day.
Do you write every day?
I try to. Some days I have so many other obligations, but most days I get at least several hours in, and my best days I get 5 or 6 hours in.
Wow. Well, Joanne, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And enjoyed reading The Far Side of the Desert, enjoyed talking about it.
Thank you. Let me mention one other little your listeners might find interesting. In the flow of for writers, you know, I talked about the website. I mean, having a website, and then my publisher said, people will have to go to your website to read your blog. You need a newsletter. And somebody said, no, you need a Substack. So this has become a new platform, relatively new platform for a lot of writers. And it's a fun platform. Mine comes out just once a month. It's for free, called On the Yellow Brick Road. And in it is the blog, is the writer at risk in the world. I review a couple of books, some words you might like to know, and just news on the book. And so the Substack is a fun platform for a lot of writers. So you can look up and find a writer. But mine is On the Yellow Brick Road, and it's for free. And the link to it, you also can find on my website, which I gave the address.
I find myself on Substack almost every day.
Yeah, yeah. There's lots of fun things, and you get to go directly to writers are thinking or saying or talking about. It's a good platform. It's an easy platform to work on.
Well, thank you, Joanne. I want to close with the quote, which we, as we always do, and this is from Rabbi Sacks. The victims of terror are not only the dead and injured, but the very values on which a free society is built. Trust, security, civil liberty, tolerance, the willingness of countries to open their doors to asylum seekers, the gracious safety of public places.
Beautiful quote. Thank you.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it and enjoy the interview.